cruel, violent, endless. It doesn't seem right killing animals and then eating them. That's what some say when they talk about why they are vegetarians. I appreciated hearing Pam share her story today, and what struck me was her empathy, the empathy she has for animals. It can feel unreal sometimes, thinking about the meat on our tables and how it got there. And maybe it's only when you're sitting around a table eating with others and you notice that someone is choosing not to eat meat that it gets you thinking. More and more people are choosing not to eat meat. I know there are quite a few people in our church community who are vegetarians, and I find myself learning from them. It's not good for the planet, they say. We have to use so much grain, creating vast fields just so we can have animals that we can consume. It's contributing to climate change. And maybe it's not good for our health consuming all this meat. And it doesn't seem particularly good for animals. There is a concern about intensive farming practices harming animals, causing suffering. There are a lot of confronting details when it comes to animals and farming practices that I think I'm probably ignorant of or in denial about. Consumers want meat, but we don't want to have to think about it too much, and we don't want to have to pay for it too much. Once again, I must give a disclaimer. I'm not going to be able to say everything you could on this topic, and I'm not a vegetarian, but I find myself intrigued and challenged by vegetarians. Margaret Atwood has written many brilliant books. In one trilogy, she explores a society set a little bit into the future. It's a pretty terrifying vision. Scientists live in gated communities run by corporations experimenting on animals, creating animals with human DNA that can grow human organs or grow hair for us to use as wigs. Meanwhile, outside those gated communities, the weather is extreme, most people can't afford real meat anymore, animals are almost extinct, and people eat chicky knobs, which is something that was once a chicken but is now bred to be a chicken without a head. And in the middle of this teeming chaos, there is this small religious group, God's gardeners, committed to not eating meat and growing vegetable gardens on abandoned rooftops. They celebrate animals through worship songs and hymns, while also predicting that a flood is coming which will wipe out people once and for all because people have broken trust with the animals. They sing, "Who is it that tends the garden oh so green? 'Twas once the finest garden that ever has been seen. And in it God's dear creatures did swim and fly and play. But then came greedy spoilers and killed them all away." Again, God's gardeners are intriguing to me, although in the book not many people want to join them, and they can seem at times a little bit extreme or naive. But they're motivated by their faith, and they're trying to wrestle with the challenges the world is facing. You know, one of the ways we try to make sense of our reality is through story. A story can feel unreal, and yet sometimes it's through a story that we stumble into something true. I said last week there are some serious challenges when it comes to food, and where animals fits into this, I think, is one of those challenges. I'm not going to tell you what you should eat or what you shouldn't eat. Instead, I want to tell you some stories that might seem a little unreal, and yet by entering into them, we might discover something true about our eating. The first story in the Bible opens with a focus on God bringing life. So much life in the beginning. There's the sun and then water, plants bearing seeds, blowing in the wind and multiplying, creatures in the seas and in the skies, all these wild animals roaming the land. There is abundant life and it is glorious. The song from Atwood's book draws on the story where everything is good and there are people taking their place in a garden and God is with them and it is very good. And God says, Genesis 1, verse 29, I give you the seed-bearing plants on the face of the earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be your food. And to all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. Food is a gift from God. God gives human beings, and indeed, according to this story, all living creatures, the gift of plants to eat. People are to be vegetarians, it seems, or actually probably vegans. This story could inspire you to become a vegetarian. Sometimes vegetarians seem prophetic to me, like they're drawing us back into this initial story. They challenge me. Perhaps they're pointing us to where it will all end. Part of me thinks it would be nice to just stay here in this moment. But there's also a sense of unrealness for me with this story. Can I say that? I think one of the reasons why we're drawn to this story is because it seems to evoke a time kind of almost outside of time. It's an idyllic world where everything is just right. All there is life. There is no death. And death is what we hate, what we lament. One of the major reasons why people choose to be vegetarians is out of distress, of not wanting to be responsible for an animal's death. It seems cruel. We want to get back to this moment where only life existed and there was no death. Simple. Everyone a gardener for God. But I don't really recognize this world. Maybe I don't recognize it because people did eat, and when they ate, suddenly nothing was simple. The very first bite we see people take is from the one tree God asked them not to eat from. We find it hard to stay in this pure, idyllic place. A second, darker story is told. It's almost a reversal of this first story. God looks and sees not life, but people, maybe also animals, violent and cruel, and it's spreading. And God is grieved. So God plans to wipe all of life out. But in the end, one man, Noah, and his extended family are spared. They're told to build a giant box, an ark, that will shelter them and bring pairs of all the animals they can find into the ark. A flood comes, a great flood that washes most of life away. The sun disappears from view. The waters rise and rise, crashing over land, drowning out the wild animals, bending and breaking and submerging the trees. Everything disappears and there is just destruction. This story also has a feeling of unrealness to it, doesn't it? It's dramatic and terrible, where everything seems wrong. Death dominates and life is just a flicker. One boat bopping up and down on the waves, so fragile. You have two extreme stories side by side, one describing life and the other describing death. And in between those two moments, there is Noah spending months and months enclosed in this wooden boat. And what is he doing? Feeding the animals. You need to eat to live. And this is what God has called him to do. Feed the animals, care for them, make sure they live. And so he does. He shows hospitality. Some rabbis, when they tell this story, say Noah is so busy that he barely has time to sleep. It is hard work. They're all crammed together. He doesn't know how long he needs to keep these animals alive, but he gives all that he has. He mimics God in some way, learning to care and sustain life on board this boat. It is costly. Finally, the rain eases. There's a crack of light. Noah steps out of the boat, feet sinking in mud. He steps out into a world that we would begin to recognize more. There's life beginning again. The animals are making their way out of the boat. The birds are taking to the skies. But there's also death. Noah's response is to build an altar. He kills some of the animals and offers them to God. Why? He spent so much time caring for them. Why does he now kill some? Sacrifice doesn't make sense to us. It seems violent and cruel. We judge Noah. But in fact, he confronts reality more than we tend to. Life is messy. But it's also a gift. He wants to give a gift to God, a costly gift. He's trying to acknowledge the grace they've received. They've made it. They're alive. And he wants to dedicate himself to God. He expresses himself through sacrifice. In a sense, he's pledging his life to God here, recognizing it all belongs to God. And God, bizarrely to us, smells the meat cooking, likes the smell, and makes the promise to never again curse the ground and destroy all living creatures before giving new instructions around eating. Genesis 9, verse 3. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. Now people can eat animals. Some scholars say that this is God making a concession, accommodating to the fact that sin and death are in the world, and the hope is that one day there'll be no more death. That's how I've tended to read the story. But I want to ask this question this morning. Is death always bad? Is death always bad? And I ask this because when I read scientific accounts of how the world began, or even when I read scientific accounts of the world now, they speak about the cycle of life and death and how decay, decomposition, death is necessary for life to flourish on Earth. We need bacteria to do the work of breaking things down and metabolizing. Soil needs death. It takes death, recycling plant debris and carcasses to have new life. Without this, nothing grows. There'd be no trees and flowering plants. And without them, there'd be no animals or people. I have it deep in my head that death is always bad, evil. But maybe both life and death can be good when approached as a gift. Maybe this is how God sustains and cares for us in this cycle of life and death. Maybe what these stories in Genesis together are trying to teach us is something that we don't like to acknowledge much today, but ancient people were much more aware of. Every time we eat, we are at the crossroads between life and death. Eating is messy. If we don't eat, we die. But we can't eat without death. We have to draw on others, whether that's animals or plants or even things we can't see like bacteria, microbes, to eat well. We need to confront the reality of death. To eat well, we need to recognize we depend on others to live. We need soil. We need sun. We need plants. We need animals. so many involved in sustaining and keeping us going. When we're born, we rely on others feeding us. Often parents sacrifice, lay down their lives, their time, their resources, so their children can eat and grow. Genesis speaks about how much we need God. Every time we eat, we're relying on God. We need God to care and sustain this world. And maybe part of the way that God does that is through death. It's costly. There can be an unrealness to eating when we fail to acknowledge how life and death go hand in hand, how linked we are to others. Every time I eat, even if I was just eating plants, others have died, microbes, insects, plants, and animals, so I can live. I don't think we like to remember that because that feels really heavy. Why should others die so I can live? Norman Wasby says this is why the language of sacrifice is so important. Noah's story can help us make sense of this weight. It teaches us our response should be gratitude. Learning to give our lives as a gift to others. Learning to be involved in the work of sustaining and keeping others going, including plants and animals. And it will be costly. We want to make sure that the death and sacrifices others make are not for nothing, and that we are part of this cycle too, giving so that others can live. The sacrificial logic I've been describing and the self-offering care that it takes and self-offering care that is its practical correlate suggests that animals can be eaten in ways that respect their integrity and well-being and that honors God. But for the condition to be met, it is crucial that these animals be accorded the attention and care that reflects God's own self-giving care for creation. It's a quote from Norman Wasby. Noah learned to live in a world full of life and death by spending time in close relationship, feeding animals, surrounding himself with life and death. And the Israelites had followed this pattern in a close relationship with animals, raising them, bringing them to God. And when they killed them for food, doing so with respect and attention, it was a significant act to eat meat. If we are to eat meat, this is the attitude we should have, with care and attention. Perhaps we need to get closer to animals once more, closer to death, make it real. Maybe if we did, we'd have to change our practices. We often judge the Israelites and Noah for their sacrifices, but they were much more upfront with the reality of death and what it took to eat meat. I think we need to confront that reality more. In Genesis 9, God goes on to say to Noah, he's not to eat meat that has blood in it. And the point here, again, is to take seriously the fact that this is a life. Then God makes a covenant, not just with Noah, but with all animals, promising that death will never overwhelm them completely. Never again will waters become such a flood that all of life is destroyed. Here is God committing himself to this world and the creatures in it. He is entering the mess. God will give. God will love all the creatures in this world, even if it costs him. The ultimate expression of God's love, of course, is Jesus laying down his life so that we, and in fact all of creation, might know resurrection. How do you respond to that grace, to that sacrifice? By seeking to give our lives to God, give our lives to those around us, including animals. We are called to this pattern of dying to ourselves and living in an act of love. And we trust that one day, despite all the eating we do, our time will come to die. But we trust that there can be a good death, one that brings life to others. And we trust that even though biologically we die, yet in Christ we live. The question is not so much if we eat meat or we don't, but how we approach it. Stories are one way we can be drawn into what is real, even strange stories. There's a lot of practices that cause extreme harm to animals that we need to confront. We need to sit with the cost of eating and living and commit ourselves to give to God, to others. Margaret Atwood, after she'd written her book, discovered small Christian groups actually living out some of the principles she describes of God's gardeners. And she muses that if more Christians cared about animals, the world could be a radically different place. A terrible future doesn't have to be what unfolds. It has been forgotten, but once Christians were the champions of animals and animal welfare. In 1832, anti-cruelty legislation was introduced in England because Christians were concerned with how farm animals were being treated. The churches campaigned together, calling for change. The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, what we now know as the RSPCA, began with Christians. Today there's an organisation called Creature Kind trying to encourage Christians to care for the well-being, particularly of farm animals. You might not eat meat. You might reduce your meat intake. You might choose what type of meat you buy and examine the farming conditions for that animal. Whatever we choose, let's not live in the unreal and deny the cost of our eating. Let's choose to be real, take the cost seriously, and seek to live good lives. Expanding our care to animals and the world around us as an act of worship.